This episode of the Living Poetry Podcast was recorded on the 1st of April, 2012. My name is Bartholomew Barker, and I'm joined by Tara Lynn Groff, Pamela Taylor, and Angelica Teuber. We're the organizers of Living Poetry, a collection of poets and poetry readers in the Raleigh-Durham metropolitan area of North Carolina. Check out livingpoetry.net, search for Living Poetry on Facebook, and if you reside in the Piedmont, join our Living Poetry meetup group. Tonight we're joined by Terry Kirby Erickson, an award-winning author of three collections of poetry, Thread Count, Telling Tales of Dusk, In the Palms of Angels, which was released by Press 53 in April of last year. It's been a whole year now.
It has. It's been a whole year since the last one, just about.
Her work has also appeared in numerous literary journals, anthologies, and other publications. I counted over 40 credits online. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Erickson, welcome to the Living Poetry Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
No problem. Let's start at the beginning. When did you first start writing poetry?
Well, let's see. I was probably about 10 years old, 9 years old in the fifth grade, and I had a wonderful fifth grade teacher. It was her first year teaching, as a matter of fact, so she tried to teach us everything that ever happened in the entire world, all of the arts. We did dancing. I was Lady Macbeth in a play. And so I got to be the star of the play. I actually tried out for the witch, but she thought I was such a great witch that she wanted me to try out for the evil queen. So, I wrote my first poem in her class. And it was about snow, and I compared old snow to newspapers, which my fifth grade teacher said was brilliant. Mm-hmm. Because she said that to all of us about everything we did, no matter what, you know. So, anyway, she introduced us to literature in a way that was very meaningful to me. So I read a lot of poetry. I became an English major in college. But I didn't start writing poetry for publication until I was about 45 years old. So there's a big gap in there.
Did something prompt you to start writing poetry again?
I had been writing it. I just hadn't been sending it anywhere or trying to get it published by anybody. And I was always the one to write funny Christmas poems or birthday poems. And I, wrote them privately. If I needed some kind of emotional catharsis, I would write a poem. But I just never really tried to do anything with it. So I went to a poetry reading with a friend of mine at Salem College, and Rita Dove was the poet. And her presence is just so commanding. And, she walked up to the microphone and just took over the room with her voice and her presence and her poetry. And I just thought to myself, that's really what I want to be doing. It's what I've always wanted to be doing. So what am I waiting for? And so I went home, I think, that evening and started jotting down a few lines. So it took me about a year and a half, I'd say, to amass a lot of poems, probably about 125 poems. And because I had no connections, really, and I hadn't had anything published, and I didn't really know what to do with any of it, I decided to publish the first book myself, which sounds daunting, but was really kind of easy, I found a place that was recommended to me called Author House. I really didn't think anything would happen other than my mother and my father would like a copy, my daughter would like it, maybe my friends, this will be fun. I really didn't think of it necessarily as being a career because I didn't know if they were good or not. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know, how good I am. Or terrible. And so, I put the book together and there's poems about everything in that book, I like to say everything but the kitchen sink, but there's actually a poem about a kitchen sink in that book. So, because I thought, I may never publish anything else. I'm going to put every poem in here that I have written, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the best thing in the world, but, it's mine, so I'm going to put it in here. There's no one to tell me I can't. So, unfortunately for me, my uncle, Stephen White, is a really well-known North Carolina artist, and I thought it would be a boon to have his painting on the cover of my book, and it's turned out to be really terrific because he's done all the paintings for all my covers. And so that didn't hurt a bit to have his artwork on the cover. But, you know, I sold every one of those books, just about, except for a few, because, you know, when you create your own book, you have to buy them and all of that. I mean, there's a lot of expense involved, but not as much as you think. But I ended up, I was on television. I did a commercial for the English department at Winston-Salem State. I was on the radio on NPR, our local NPR station. I had several radio interviews. I was in the newspaper. People were buying the books. People were coming to poetry readings. It was just an amazing unfolding for somebody who didn't know what they were doing. And by doing that, you know, I got my name out there from that first book. And it doesn't always work as successfully for everybody. It just so happens it worked well for me. And I never had sent that manuscript to anybody, so I don't know if anyone, you know, would have published it or not. But it was probably right after that book came out that Press 53 went into business. And I heard of Press 53, and they were asking for poems. And so I sent them about 10 poems, and that's about all I had because I had put, as you remember, the kitchen sink and the other one. So I didn't really have very many new ones. So Kevin Watson, who is the owner of Press 53, contacted me and said he liked my work a great deal and wanted to meet me. So I was, as you can imagine, thrilled out of my mind and met with him, and he said, I really like your work. When you have another manuscript, I'd like to see it. And he gave me some advice about getting published and, you know, to get my poems out there in literary journals and enter some contests and doing that kind of, I mean, honestly, I knew nothing about how to be a poet and what you know, that entailed as far as, you know, building a writing resume and all of that. So that's basically how I came to the attention of Press 53. So they published my second and third book.
Did you end up being a part of a community, like a workshop or something, so you didn't write so much in isolation, that you got your poems maybe critiqued by a group or looked at by a group?
No, never. And I still don't do that. Okay. I prefer to work, to do my own writing. And actually, it's interesting because my husband reads all of my poetry, and he has more of an engineering mentality. He would not have picked up a poem for $1 million, you know, unless it was my poetry. But the reason I enjoy having him read my work is because he will tell me if it doesn't resonate with him. Mm-hmm. If he doesn't feel anything or he doesn't understand it, then I revisit, you know, the poem, because I like to write poetry that is accessible and that people can read and get. Mm-hmm. And if he doesn't, then I feel like probably nobody's going to. So, you know, that's really great. But I haven't never really been interested in having a critique group. You know, maybe I'm just too prickly and I don't like criticism, you know. Maybe that's what it is. But, you know, I just really like to either do well or not on my own. Mm-hmm. I want my work to be just my work. And if, you know, if I had a group that was looking at it, I just don't know if I would feel the same way about it. I wouldn't feel an ownership to it that I feel now. So, and that's not to criticize people who do that. It's a really valid way to write and to do things. But just for myself, I would rather not. You know, my process is really, I just get up early in the morning, and if I'm in a writing mode, I'll just write and write for days because I'm sort of a binge writer. And then suddenly I'm just emptied out of all words. And it's like I've never written anything, you know. It really sometimes, and then I'll look at my books and I'm like, wow, that's so weird. How'd you ever do that? And I can say I live in a town of about 10,000 people, and I can hear my blood flowing in my veins in my house. It is so quiet. You know, we live on a cul-de-sac. And there's the clock ticking and my heart beating, and that's about it. So it's as quiet as you could ever hope to find for a writing environment.
So being in a small town, do you know of other poets, or do you have to drive far to find any?
I hope and I assume there are other poets in Louisville, but I haven't met them if there are. And so if I get together with other poets, because I really love socializing with them, and I belong to the North Carolina Poetry Society, and so I love going to meetings, and I love seeing other writers and being in community with them. You know, I'm just not someone who writes with them, you know, but I like to socialize with them.
Could you talk a little bit about the difference putting this collection together now that you had, you know, you had two collections under your belt versus the first time?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it seems to me, in reading some of the poems that you submitted, that there are at least some common elements
mm-hmm.
between them, and if that was something when you were writing and picking what would go into this book that you noticed yourself?
Well, I think all of my books are kind of an eclectic mix of poetry, you know. I don't know that it necessarily has a theme. I think I just write through the experience of growing up in the South. I don't think it's regional, because I think the feelings are universal, and a lot of the experiences are universal, and they're not, you know, regional, but I'm definitely a product of the, you know, my culture and being raised in the South. So really I just write about things that move me, you know, things that make me feel something. And those are always my best poems, you know, because if I don't feel it, if I intellectualize it too much, then it comes across that way. And then, you know, people don't feel the poem when they're reading it. And in order for it to be memorable for a reader, I think you have to feel something.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because there have been poems that I have written that I thought were technically pretty good, but emotionally flat. And, you know, those are not ones that find their ways in, you know, their way into my books, hopefully. Hopefully. But, you know, I think, you know, from book to book, I feel more confident that I know what is good enough to put in it. You know what I mean? It's like the first book, I had no idea if any of it was good. You know, it was just my outpouring of poetry from that well, you know. I think I'm more discerning, you know, as I mature in doing this.
Well, could you read one of your poems? I'm thinking about Woman on the Phone.
Woman on the Phone. A tired little boy curls on the floor, on the stair, wherever his mother stands, talking on the phone. He clutches a cotton blanket, sucks his thumb as if his skin is honey. Someday he'll meet a girl, fall in love. When she leaves a room, the boy will feel as if the wind has blown through it, taking everything. For now, however, he sees no one but his mother, as if he is a sunflower and she his only source of light.
That's beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a true story.
Especially like the metaphor at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Sunflower and the boy sucking his thumb like it was skinless honey.
Yeah, and that was really the truth too. I can't believe that boy still has a thumb even after that one day, you know.
So what does the mother think of the poem?
She loves this poem.
Mm-hmm.
She really does. She's a good friend of mine, and of course it probably it's her favorite one in the book. I mean, she knows, you know, that it's about her and her son.
Mm-hmm.
So
Do you mind reading The Wayfarer? There's
sure.
Some elements in there that...
Wayfarer. He seems like a man you'd see walking down a long stretch of road, the kind with dust rising in a red haze beneath the wheels of pickup trucks, cutting through fields of golden wheat. Scudding clouds cast shadows across the ground, like whales swimming through clear water. And the air carries the scent of grain and loam. Every few miles, the glint of a silo, startling against the lonesome sky, signals a farmhouse where peach pies sit cooling on windowsills, and patterned carpets are worn out from parents pacing to and fro with fretful babies in their arms. He's traveling toward the horizon with the steady gait of someone with a place to go, whose tender gaze will soon find home, that place more sacred than communion wafers nestled in the palms of angels. That poem was inspired by someone I worked with at the Winston-Salem Journal years ago. And there was a man on the copy desk who had that kind of look of someone who needs to be outside instead of inside. And I always felt like he was constrained by the atmosphere of that place, even though it was a big room and you know, a lot of folks, and the newspaper business can be very exciting. But he looked like somebody who should be out in a field or walking down a dirt road. And while I was there, I'd only been there for a few weeks when he passed away. And he was a young man, you know, only in his 50s, which to me now is nearly kindergarten as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, and it was such a shock. And I had only known him for a little while, but it was so, you know, poignant to me that he had spent so many years in this inside office environment. And so it almost felt to me like he had been released from this, you know, place, and that maybe he was walking through the fields of heaven or something mm-hmm. like that, you know, and that kind of, I don't know, it made me feel a little bit better in the sorrow of losing him, because I always feel sad when someone leaves this world, because I love the world so much, you know. I would like to live to be 200. I think that wouldn't be enough, you know, as long as I can still eat. You know, you want to have things that you enjoy, you know.
Like the peach pies, cool.
Right, right, yeah.
That was such a great element, especially it felt very much like country and rural and mm-hmm. being, you know, peach with South, like a Georgian type of thing.
Oh, yes.
But, you know, from my perspective, not growing up in the South, mm-hmm. but, it, you know, it comes across very clearly in yours, these extra details.
Yeah, I also find that, as you just described this person, mm-hmm. to me, Pam had hit on it before in terms of themes.
Mm-hmm.
In a few of them, it seems like you have a real skill to look inside the person.
Mm-hmm.
One, to sort of pick up your idea about themes in your work, in reading it, I saw a lot of use of the elements,
mm-hmm.
like wind
mm-hmm.
and rain and the
mm-hmm.
sun, and even like the moon in the sky, that
mm-hmm.
type of, those types of imagery, and
mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you think that's, is that the influence of you as a Southern writer?
Mm-hmm.
Because being from New York,
mm-hmm.
you know, I like to, you know, I tend to write about buses and trains,
and
the things that I grew
yeah,
up with,
right.
you know, because some of that,
mm-hmm.
you know, still, like some of my greatest childhood memories of independence is being
mm-hmm.
able to go out on my own, you know, on the bus, the train, whereas,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a, you know, growing up in the South, it's, you seem to have a different perspective on things.
I think that I never came inside as a child except to eat and sleep. So as soon as I got up in the morning, if it was warm enough outside, I was, you know, I ate breakfast hurriedly, and then I was outside. And we had creeks and trees. I mean, sometimes I ate lunch in the tree in my front yard. I didn't want to come down, so my mother just handed me a sandwich up in the tree. So I can't even imagine climbing a tree now, you know? I mean, I would be stuck. They'd have to call the fire department.
You got to climb a tree.
Yeah,
after
yeah.
we're done recording this.
Yeah, you got to go out there and do it. See, I can't even imagine doing it now. And, you know, so, I mean, we were always outside, and we didn't come in until it was almost dark, you know, in the summertime. So I was always out in the elements, which is interesting now because I'm not so much now, you know, I'm more inside, you know, but I spent my entire childhood outside. So, you know, the wind, the moon, the sun, all the elements of being outside were just a huge part of forming who I am as a person. So I think that's why it comes back to me now, even though I'm not rolling around in the grass, you know, these days, you know, lately, but... I remember all of those delicious sensations.
I have a double question. One, the first question is sort of a very common question.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of your favorite poets that you read? And then the second question is, does reading inform your writing? So if you read poetry, does that inform how you maybe change up your tone, your form, the structure?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really hard to say how much other poets influence you, you know, because you take it in kind of like eating a delicious minestrone or something. You know, you've gotten all these wonderful vegetables in this medley, and you take it into your body, and it becomes part of who you are, so that you can't really separate the zucchini from you anymore, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So It's kind of hard to say when it comes to influence, but my absolute number one favorite poet is Ted Kooser. I love his work. Absolute number one. You know, there's no comparison with any other poet. To me, he is the best. Mm-hmm. And he is who I write when I want to, who I read when I want to feel inspired, you know, by poetry, and I'm feeling a little, you know, not like I really want to write, sort of lethargic about it or whatever, then I become re-enthused by reading his work, because he captures everything so beautifully and so simply with so few words, and I just absolutely am crazy about his poetry. Mm-hmm. One of the hugest honors of my life has been Ted Kooser choosing one of the poems from this book to feature.
Oh my
and
God.
Yeah, I just found that out a couple of months ago, and I think they probably could hear me screaming with, you know, ecstasy for miles, you know, all over Louisville. And how they phrased it was, would you be interested, or something like that, you know? And I was like, are you kidding me? And I was like, I couldn't even type back fast enough. I think my fingers got all, like, you know, uncoordinated trying to type back, oh my God, are you kidding me? Yes. You know, because they're asking my permission to use this poem in his column, American Life and Poetry. Yeah, so that'll be coming out, and they told me January
Oh, wow.
of 2013. Yes, absolutely. It couldn't be any other poet that I would have been more thrilled of. So I really like Joe Mills' work a lot. He's a fellow Press 53 poet, and he's so funny. I went to a reading that he had yesterday in Louisville at our library, and I always want to support people, especially when they're right in my backyard. And he has a new book coming out this year. Mm. So he's terrific. And, you know, really, there aren't too many poets that are, that I can't find something about their work that I like. Yeah. You know, even students, you know, I mean, there's usually a line, at least, that, you know, is pretty good and something to work with.
Mm-hmm. You know, so I was wondering if you could tell us the story about how your poem was written once.
Oh, yes. Well, a dear, dear friend of mine who was... I'm trying to remember. I think he was going to be 95 because he died a month before his 95th birthday. He was born on St. Patrick's Day, and he was a lovely man. And he and his wife I met some years ago at a Methodist church in Louisville. And I remember walking in the door and his wife coming up to me and saying, "Hi, welcome. You have to come sit with my husband and me. We haven't seen you before. Tell me all about yourself." You know, and she was just wonderful, you know, really outgoing. And her name was Ursula, and her husband's name was John, and you have to come sit with John and me. And so we just developed a friendship, and I would go and visit with them and sit in their backyard. And they had a pecan tree. And I remember the pecans were falling, and they were telling me how I needed to get some pecans so I could go make a pie. And I said, "I've never made a pecan pie." And he looked at me like I had three heads, you know. So I wrote a poem about them called From the Garden. And that is in my new book, In the Palms of Angels, my newest book. And this sounds like a really long and meandering story, but anyway... Ursula passed away about 3 years ago, and John was a widower. And I used to take him pumpkin pies and cookies and whatever, because he couldn't cook at all. And it was really kind of cute when he said, "I didn't realize how much that woman did around here," you know, because he didn't know how to clean or cook or anything. So he had to teach himself how to do all these things in his 90s.
So, how many years?
68 years.
68 years of no cleaning.
Yes, of no cleaning or cooking. Yeah, I mean,
it's great to be a guy.
I know. I said, but that's, you know, that's how it was back then, you know? And he had a store that, you know, it's like a general store in Louisville that's sort of famous, you know? But, I mean, he was elderly enough to where he retired in the 60s, you know? Imagine, you know? So anyway, and he was a great supporter of my poetry. He came to my second launch party at the Louisville Library for my second book, and he wasn't well enough to come to the one for the new book, but he had it, and he really enjoyed that poem that he knew was about him and his wife. So when he passed away not that long ago, I went to his memorial service and was just sitting there and listening to the eulogy. And all of a sudden, the minister said, I'd like to read a poem by our local Louisville award-winning poet, Terry Kirby Erickson. And I was like, you know, I mean, just couldn't believe it. And so he read that poem, and I was so honored and amazed. But it was a strange experience to have someone else, especially in that context, you know, when I was already feeling emotional and, you know, thinking about my friend. But I was also happy, you know, in this way, because I knew that he was with his wife. You know, I feel that there is an afterlife and that he was with his wife, who he missed so much and loved so much. And I knew that he was ready to go. You know, he had told me, you know, he had had about enough, you know, and he missed her and wanted to be with her. So, you know, for him, it was, you know, a homecoming. And so in that case, a memorial service is more a celebration of the life of the person. And because you don't get a much better run than being almost 95 years old and living most of your life in complete and utter wedded bliss. Because I have never seen a couple who were as crazy about each other as the two of them. And that's a pretty darn good run. And most of us don't get that. And so, but hearing my poem read in that context, it was really emotional for me. And such an honor, you know, because he was such a kind and wonderful man. And to have my poem read at his service meant a great deal to me. Mm-hmm. And afterward he said, I wish I had known you were going to be there. I would have gotten you to read it. And I said, you know, I really don't know if I could have, mm-hmm. you know.
Could you read it for us now?
Sure. Again, I have to find it.
Even though it was an emotional time for you, mm-hmm. did you notice that when they read it that there was different inflections at points that you're like, oh, maybe that is a better way to read it, or anything that you kind of picked up being an audience for yourself?
You know, not really, because I was so overcome that he was actually even reading it. Yeah, it was almost that like I was in shock, you know, that he was reading it, and I couldn't believe I was even hearing it, you know. It was just a really sort of cosmic experience, you know. So, I mean, I thought he did a great job. You know, he asked me after the service was over, did I do your poem justice? And I'm like, well, absolutely, you know. The fact that you even read it was amazing. But anyway, this is called From the Garden for John and Ursula. These are the last of the beans, she said, handing me a sack. So they won't be as good as the first. We sat a while in the shade of twin pecan trees in their backyard, beside the grape arbor and fig trees near the summer garden. Her husband laughed when I confessed I'd never made a pecan pie and seemed to think I should get cracking. He said, come by any time. You can have all the pecans you can carry. I asked how long they'd been married, and he quickly replied, she won't tell you. But it was long enough to create this gentle peace between them, no doubt hard won. If we never fought, it'd be boring, she said with a grin, a gleam in her eyes that no amount of years could diminish. He grinned back, and the feeling between them seemed warm and sacred, like a ray of light through a stained glass window. Be sure and add potatoes to your beans, she said before I left, her parting words being, I wish we'd met you sooner when the garden was full, as if a garden like theirs could ever be empty.
That is emotional. I don't even know what them.
Yeah, they were lovely. And just, you know, being able to watch them interact with each other, you know, was just a wonderful thing. So I wanted to capture that.
So how do you, now that you're more of an established poet, right, you mm-hmm. feel at home at the community, mm-hmm. How do you stay connected with the poetry community, and what do you do to grow in your writing? Mm-hmm. Like conferences, or what do you do to stay connected and grow?
Well, I think just, yes, attending conferences, you know, going out into the community and hearing other poets read, like I went out to hear Joe read yesterday. That's always inspiring. I continue to read poetry. I read it online. I read the books that I have in my insane office. It looks like a book explosion. Yeah, that's pretty much what I do. And I, and sometimes I write articles about poetry. I do write articles for magazines. So I wrote something that came out in the as a guest column in the Winston-Salem Journal not too long ago, called Poetry for Everyday Use, which is, you know, just kind of promoting poetry as something that is not just something you read in school and in agonies of horror that you have to do it, but that, you know, you can read it every day, you know, and you should read it every day because it's so meaningful, you know. And I wrote a little bit about how World War II soldiers used to carry poems with them into battle. I read that German soldiers carried Rilke into battle. So, you know, it has inspired people through the ages, and I think it's still inspiring to people now. So I write about that, and that reminds me, you know, too, how powerful poetry is.
Yeah. Mandela apparently got through his 27 years of imprisonment with Invictus.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That doesn't surprise me at all, because if a poem speaks to you, I mean, it goes right into your heart and soul. And it's so immediate, and it almost just goes through your skin and it stays with you. And people can remember poems, and they remember lines from poems.
Could you read The Shrimp Boat Captain? Because you're nodding here to Henley in that poem.
Okay. This one won first place in a poetry contest, so I was pretty thrilled about that.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Shrimp Boat Captain. The craggy-faced shrimp boat captain keeps a pinch of chewing tobacco between his lip and gum, wears faded blue overalls and a ball cap. Early mornings, you'll find him lumbering down the road towards an old wooden pier, carrying a cooler filled with ice, a fishing rod slung over his beefy shoulder. Tackle swings like a pendulum behind his back until he reaches his favorite bench close to the end. He pulls a bag of shrimp from the cooler, baits his hooks, and casts his line as far as arthritis allows. Sits there until noon, either catching fish or not, it's all the same to him. It's the sun and wind and rain he's come for, the view of shrimp boats headed out to sea, crews tiny as toy soldiers. He can hear the cries of hungry gulls, feel each vessel's pitch and toss, though he is captain of nothing now save his own soul. And what his soul wants is to keep his body close to water until the moon captures him in her net and lifts it with cool white hands into the starry sky.
Beautiful. Love that last line.
Yeah. Thank you. I spent a lot of time at the beach when I was a child. You know, the times that I wasn't actually directly at the beach, I was thinking about the beach, because we used to go for a week every summer with my grandma and my parents and my brother, and you know, it was just an idyllic long time. It seemed to me like it lasted 3 months. It probably seemed that way to my mother and my grandmother too, because you know, having to watch over us near the ocean, you know, I'm sure my mother was in trauma, you know. And they were cooking, because we always rented a cottage, and they cleaned and cooked and worked their little fingers to the bone while we had a good time. But we had so much fun, and you know, I just think that sometimes in my poetry I'm trying to recapture that feeling of home and safety, and when everything is sweet and good, and even if it was only the illusion of a child. So, you know, I just feel like sometimes I'm trying to get back to that place.
Aside from the creative and the sensual side of your writing, and having the books, and then you also write for magazines too sometimes, so the business side of your writing, how do you plan your speaking engagements? Do you get invited? Do you blog and interact on Facebook and find you connect with readers more there, or how do you spend your time?
Well, I really enjoy the marketing end. The reason is because it's so nice to see human beings, you know, again, after being sequestered in my little office, you know, where you can hear a pin drop. So it's nice to be out there and talking to them. And I studied communications. I did an English literature and communications double major in school. And so I studied PR, and I used to write radio advertising years and years ago, back when they had 8-track tapes. So, you know, this was a while ago. And anyway, so I could, you know, write copy about tires and barbecue and, you know, anything really. So I was used to, I had that experience in my past of working in advertising, which helps. And as you can probably see, I can talk to a rock. So I don't have any trouble communicating with people, and I enjoy doing it. So I like that. So, you know, I've done all kinds of things. I mean, I reach out to people online and say, you know, my name, and I write poetry. And guess what? There's a poem about an Irish setter in my book. You know, I might write to the Kennel Club. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I do obscure kind of things like that, you know, and you sell books that way. You know, they'll be excited. And, you know, even if you only sell one book, you know, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And there was a poem in my second book about that had cream of wheat in it. Man, I wrote to the cream of wheat people. And I also wrote to the Vidalia onion people when I wrote a poem about Vidalia onions, and the CEO of that company still buys my books. Oh, oh yes, she does. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
That's amazing.
Yes, there's just, I have no shame.
So well, that's great that you can put your work out there and you're proud of it behind it, because there's, you know, lots of, you go to open mics and stuff, sometimes people apologize for a poem before it or something.
Oh, man, that will never happen.
Really
yeah. You know, I just feel, I feel so grateful that I have found the words and have been able to put them down on paper. You know, what if I had all this inside of me and nowhere for it to go, you know? And that's why poetry, I think, another reason it's so important is that people identify with it and they feel that same catharsis, you know, a lot of times that you felt in writing it. So you're really, you know, helping people to connect with their own emotions and their own experiences. But I do like the marketing. And things come, you know, to me out of the blue. I mean, somebody will write me and say, you know, I read your book. Will you come and talk to my class? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I really like your work. We have, you know, an open mic. I'd like to feature you. Mm-hmm. Sometimes my publisher, you know, will, you know, have things for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that's pretty much my style, you know, and just whatever comes up in a serendipitous way or whatever I get out there and work for. So, but I enjoy the marketing, and I like launch parties, particularly are fun. The one that I had for this book was great because the Cancer Center invited me to have the launch party at the Cancer Center, and I donated 10% of the book profits to a fund called the Simstein Fund, which helps folks who can't afford, like, extraneous costs of their care, mm-hmm. like transportation and that kind of thing. So we probably had about 150 people who came to that party. As a matter of fact, I thought, you know, when I saw the giant room, and I thought, oh, my God, this is going to be terrible. There'll be 4 people here, and it's going to be so embarrassing. And we had all this food, and I'm like, we're going to have to take this food home. We're going to have this for days. And, you know, they had set up all these chairs. Oh, God, that's too many chairs. I'm going to be reading to these empty chairs. And what happened was it was so full of, the room was packed with people. They were spilling into the lobby. And I've had people come up to me and tell me that they wanted to come to my party, but they couldn't get in. And the table where the food was looked like army ants had gone through it. There were crumbs. That was all that was left. And John Ely came to my book launch party. And I saw him in the audience and just literally freaked out on my. I had to mention him. I'm like, oh, my God, John Ely is here, you know. And so I was just thrilled out of my mind. He's a literary icon. And but it was just an amazing turnout of people, you know, supporting the work and supporting the Cancer Center. And so that was a lot of fun. I love that.
Mm-hmm. So what advice would you have for new poets or people trying to get published?
Well, I think just keep writing, you know. I mean, even for myself, I think the more I write, I feel like I'm getting better, at least I hope. You know, I never want to have one of those books where people say, oh, gee, she's obviously past her prime, poor thing. It's just not the quality work she used to write, you know. So I always want them, you know, the books to be better. And, you know, I think to go ahead and send your work out. If you have something that you think is good, which is, you know, you're the only one who can tell that at that point, you know, go ahead and send it to journals and see. All they can say is no, mm-hmm. you know, and continue. And if you keep getting the same poem back, maybe there's something that's not quite right about it. Rework it. But if you really believe in the poem, just go ahead and tell yourself it's just those darn editors, you know, they're just not getting it, and keep sending it. But and read a lot of poetry. There's Ted Kooser wrote a great book called The Poetry Home Repair Manual, which I think is terrific. Mm-hmm. And I think Kim Adonisio wrote something too. I'm not sure of the name of her book.
Poet's Companion.
Yeah.
Together with Dorian Lux.
There you go. Mm-hmm. That's the one. And those books are very helpful. Continue to read other people's work and just don't give up. You know, if you believe in your work and you believe in yourself, continue to move forward and keep doing it. So that's the only advice. And also, I guess what I tell the kids is live your life. You know, leave the video games alone for a couple of hours. Get off the cell phone. You know, go out into the world. And you know, actually, you don't have to travel to write poetry. You can write poetry just in your own, you know, living room. Or your office, or wherever, in your backyard. There are a million, zillion subjects. So, I don't know if that's helpful, but, you know, that's what I say.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been
Thank
a lot
you.
Of fun.
Yeah.
And that concludes this episode of the Living Poetry Podcast. Please visit our website, livingpoetry.net. If you have any comments or questions, please send an email to podcast@livingpoetry.net. This has been Bartholomew Barker, Tara Lynn McGraw, Pamela Taylor, Angelica Toiber, and our special guest, Terry Kirby Erickson, Living Poetry.